You're listening to Opus Talks, where you'll be in on conversations with insiders in the energy, chemicals, and environmental commodities markets. Guests share insights into the latest trends and innovations, industry challenges, and much more. Let's dive into the conversations that explore where the energy economy is headed, right here on Opus Talks.
Hi, everybody. I'm James Stevenson, and welcome to the latest edition of Opus Talks. I run the research group in coal, metals, and mining within Dow Jones. And in today's edition of Opus Talks, we're going to be talking about tariffs. And back in April last year, we launched a new deliverable called Tariff Talk, coincidentally. And ever since then, we've talked about issues in macroeconomics, and such as tariffs, and also things like geopolitics, and it's become one of our most read reports. So we've been absolutely thrilled. With me is the mastermind behind Tariff Talk, Charles Dayton. Charles, can you introduce yourself for the audience?
Yeah, James. Good morning, everyone. So as James said, my name is Charles Dayton. My background is kind of a finance background. Worked my way up there, switched over into the mining industry, running investor relations for one of the large coal producers. And from there, ended up in a small company that was bought, which is now part of all of our Opus group. So when I was given the opportunity to kind of expand beyond just coal and coking coal and look at some of the kind of economic, macroeconomic stuff going on and write about it, I jumped at the chance and I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, and long-term readers might remember Charles was the main contributor to COVID coverage that went to all IHS Mark subscribers way back in the very early 2020s. Let's get straight into things. The big tariff story lately is, of course, the US Supreme Court ruling, which effectively threw out Trump's tariffs under the IEEPA. Charles, this wasn't a great surprise, right? Talk us through your thoughts.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, giving us kind of credit where credit is due, we called this and said this wasn't constitutional and would never pass Supreme Court muster. So we got that one right there. Essentially, the IEPA or IEPA, as the cool kids call it, that was kind of formed under part of this 1974 Trade Act. This was really in response to some of the liberties Richard Nixon took with the 1917 Trading with the Enemy Act, which I wish we could name things like that today. It's such a fantastic name. And they wanted to kind of curtail some of the presidential power because Nixon did a universal tariff, for example. And Congress wasn't very pleased with that because Congress has the power to tax and things like that. So as part of that, this came out. So as a result, since this was kind of created to reduce some of the seemingly unlimited powers on trade that Nixon had, we weren't very surprised that the particular statute they used, IEPA, was struck down by the courts. It probably should have been. We're not terribly surprised by that.
And it's clear that this is not the end of tariffs. And I think within 4 or 5 hours, President Trump had given a press conference kind of detailing the tariffs would remain. And in one of our most recent editions, we walked through the various kind of vehicles the U.S. administration can use to bring those back in. And we're just going to take a minute here to kind of go through them one at a time. 122 under the 1974 Trade Act is the one that the president has identified. Could you talk us through just what that is and how that works, Charles?
Yeah, sure. So long story short, it's a kind of temporary up to 150-day, up to 15% tariff the president can levy. He chose 10%, and by the weekend, he'd raise it to 15%.
15% is the maximum, right?
It is the maximum, so he's already at it, yeah. The legality of it is somewhat questionable. This kind of stems from back when we were still on the gold standard, right? So essentially, when you have your currency pegged to something like gold, in the case of the dollar back then, you can have what's called a balance of payments deficit, meaning that somebody else is buying a whole lot and that money is not recycling back into your economy. And as a result, you can have all kinds of issues. We've written on Japan running into this with trying to keep a lid on the yen from weakening too much, for example. But as soon as we went off the gold standard and became just fiat currency, that's no longer really possible. The dollar will just weaken or strengthen when there is a difference in balance of payments, and it never really happens. It's why we saw in the 80s, for example, Japanese firms buying heavily into U.S. real estate. There was a trade deficit there, and that's kind of how that solved itself. So to claim that now with no balance of payments issue and not even one that's possible, it's not really going to be legally sound. I don't know how long it'll take for the courts to rule on it. But because you can't really have a balance of payments deficit, which is very different from a balance of trade deficit, then this seems like kind of a difficult one to use as your basis. Although they'll try to do it again, like you said, for the next up to 150 days. And given how slow moving the courts are, I'd kind of be surprised for the courts to intervene on this before that time is up.
And we've seen a number of court rulings pertaining to many issues where courts have said, look, we'll leave this in while we consider. So I think, yeah, I agree with you. I think that 5-month timeframe is, it will probably challenge court timeframes to get a ruling any quicker than that. But the president also detailed section 301 of the same 1974 Trade Act. Can you talk us through that one?
Yeah, sure. With 301, you basically have to show that whatever you're putting a tariff against is an imminent threat to the U.S. or to a certain U.S. company or something like that. So the problems with that are, one, you have to have a specific use case written out, a case for this specific tariff for each individual tariff for each individual country, which is a lot of work on its own. But once those are all written out, which is all done by the U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer, who's going to have a really busy time ahead of him, they all become public. And not only that, you even have a public comment period and everything else for it. Oh, wow. So the IEEPA kind of allowed him to... Yeah, one weekend he didn't like, I remember he didn't like what was happening in the movie industry and put a tariff on movies being made in foreign countries. You can't really kind of capriciously do that now. And instead, you have to give justification for every single tariff you put in, for every single country you do it for. And again, it all becomes public record. So that's a lot more cumbersome. And there's a lot more scrutiny in what you're doing and why you're doing it, which is why I think the administration decided not to look at going this route in the first place.
And you're also a bit dubious about them using Section 338 of the 1930 Tariff Act, correct?
Yeah, so you'll see some saying kind of 338 is another option, which Trump himself has not really looked at, because essentially it runs afoul of favored nations aspects of the World Trade Organization. And I don't think the U.S. really wants to launch into a war with the WTO right now. But still, it's something to keep in mind. And that's another tool in the toolkit that Trump can look at and use if he wants to. I just don't think it's as likely because, you know, again, there's going to be blowback with your trading partners even more than the current tariff regime would indicate.
And it's worth highlighting here, too, that tariffs under Section 232, primarily on steel and aluminum or aluminium, are unaffected by this ruling. This was specific to the IEEPA, is that what you say? So those are unaffected, although there's been a little bit of scuttlebutt lately. They could be lowered, but you think that might just be signaling, testing what the market reaction is to that signal rather than something serious, right?
Yeah, Peter Navarro came out after they signaled that and basically said it was fake news. There was no plan to it at all. And 232 is kind of the only one that doesn't hinge on this 1974 Trade Act. So this is the Trade Expansion Act of 1962. And, you know, again, there's got to be national security concerns to levy these things and keep them in place. So, you know, kind of, I would say it feels like a cousin to these other 301 tariffs that they're probably going to end up doing. But with these two, we get to read kind of the justification for it as well. And again, it's a lot easier, I think, to justify tariffs on lumber or steel for national security concerns than Swiss watches or movies or something like that.
Now, look, I think we could probably talk tariffs all day, and I'm sure in future episodes of this we will. But one of the things that you've been really focused on the last few weeks, or really two things, one is jobs and one is inflation. And in these, we're focusing on the United States. And we do have a lot of clients in the US, but we also have a lot of clients globally. Why do these numbers matter, not only for the United States, but also really the global economy?
Yeah, sure. So the Federal Reserve, as we know, has kind of a dual mandate in its job description. One of that is maximize employment, and the other side is stable prices. So it raises or cuts rates trying to get those two in balance. And so if you have any issues on the maximize employment side, which would be the jobs report, which we've written about, then that part of their dual mandate kind of gets thrown out of whack. Conversely, if you have any issues on inflation and CPI, that stable prices part of it gets affected as well, and that gets thrown out of whack. So I think anyone within the listening range to what I'm talking about would agree that the Fed funds rate is probably one of the most important things for the global economy, not just the U.S. Deciding to raise or lower the Fed funds rate when it's not necessarily warranted affects inflation, affects the dollar when everything is traded in the dollar. Having a strengthening or weakening dollar matters hugely. And the old adage, right, that if the U.S. sneezes and the rest of the world gets a cold, we have to look at it here as well, right? The U.S. still remains by far, you know, the largest economy in the world and by leaps and bounds, the largest stock market in the world as well. So it's very important with these two pillars of what the Fed's mandate is to understand them and make sure they're being presented correctly. Because if they're not, then we're sending the wrong signals to the Fed. The Fed is therefore enacting the wrong policy, and we run into issues globally in the economy as a whole.
And that's really the concern that you've been highlighting. Why don't we start on the jobs side? Because I think those numbers came in first. I think you put that issue out maybe 3 weeks ago. What are your concerns in terms? I think the number for January, the headline number was 133,000 new jobs. But is that stat? Did we really add 133,000 new jobs in January here in the U.S.?
So the jobs reports are interesting. They come out with a headline number. And then a couple of months later, there's something called a QCW. It's basically a report that comes out from the census that actually rectifies everything by looking at actual tax filings and things like that to determine what actual jobs added were. So the headline number matters, but it's not the most important number as our kind of second and final revisions. And we've run into an issue. If you look at our articles, we'll write about how, you know, the headline number looked good pretty much the entire year going up into Biden's re-election campaign. I guess it turned into Kamala Harris's. But then every revision that was done with this revised them down. So that's an issue, right? That if every time it looks good and gets revised down later, President Trump came out and said he's not sure the BLS head was being honest. I'm not sure if that's the problem or it was just kind of an error in the model, but, you know, there is an error there. So
and what magnitude are those revisions?
So let me give you an example. For 2025, things look pretty good, right? And just to kind of put it in comparison, in 2024, we averaged about 186,000 jobs a month added, right? Then if you look at 2025, however, with the revision that came out last week, what do you think the average monthly revision was for 2025 numbers? If we were doing monthly, you know, again, 186,000 jobs a month in 2024, how was 2025?
To be clear, I cover commodities. So for the audience, I don't track those numbers myself. I'd say maybe 100,000 a month.
Yeah, so you're pretty close. It ended up at 181,000 for the entire year. So that's not even monthly. So we had a revision, a decrease of 862,000 jobs. We ended up with 181,000 for the entire year. So when you're looking at the magnitude of this, all of last year, the Fed was thinking we were adding somewhere pretty close to where we were in 2024, not quite as good, but still adding a decent amount of jobs. And instead, we've added, math is hard, but about a 13th of the jobs we did in 2024 and 2025. And to your point, if we added 181,000 jobs for all of 2025 combined, yes, it would be great if that headline number was correct and we added 131,000 jobs in January alone. But again, history has shown us it's very unlikely that anything changed starting in January, that all of a sudden everyone went on a hiring spree and we're looking at roughly 10 times the amount of jobs added that we did on average per month in 2025.
So almost. So it sounds like the punchline is that 133,000 jobs number will probably be revised down substantially. Let's look at inflation now, where it seems there's an analogous set of issues. And I was just editing your piece on inflation, you know, a few days ago at the time of recording, and which, by the way, is the 25th of February. So I think this will come out in about a week. I was really struck. I think the headline inflation number was something like 2.2 or 2.4%. And I just thought through, you know, how much a cost of a pizza has gone up, or cost of energy, or cost of healthcare. And the gut feel is 2.2, 2.4 feels very low. Can you talk us through some of the issues you're seeing in that headline CPI number?
Yeah, and sure. Let's use the pizza as an example here, James. So we came in at 2.4%. I know the president says inflation is at zero. It was about 2.7 when he took office. So it's down slightly, but inflation targets for the Fed are 2. So we've been above that for several years now, over 3 years, I believe. So that still remains an issue. But let's look at a pizza, for example. The BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, does a couple of different things with the price of that pizza over time. Let's say, for example, your pizza place invented stuffed crust pizza tomorrow. And BLS says, okay, we think stuffed crust is a better quality pizza than the pizza that James was eating before. BLS will do what's called a hedonic adjustment, where they'll say, okay, pizza inflation was 5% last month, but that stuffed crust is pretty good and it adds value to James, so we're going to make it 2% instead. The biggest example, if anyone wants to look at our article, we use televisions as an example, where the actual absolute price has fallen from about $1,000. We'll use $1,000 as an example, from $1,000 to $18.50 today, which again, no one thinks was true, but because we've had flat news and everything else, you know, we say there have been better things that have been added, therefore that makes sense.
So you're saying $1,000 TV in 2020, was it? They would say the equivalent now would cost $18.
Right. 1.85% of the price in 2000 is how much it's gone down by the official data. But again, this is all these.
It's not vacuum tube TVs and right. Even having LED, all those things.
And you can see that argument, right? That we'll go back to your pizza. If you have a soft crust pizza, that's a better than a regular pizza. The other side of the argument is, well, you still need to eat that pizza, right? You still need that TV. So there are arguments against kind of that hedonic adjustment, but that's not really kind of our only issue. The Fed likes, or the BLS likes to take into account substitutions. So for example, you know, cattle prices are up nearly 40% since the beginning of 2004. And we've all seen our beef prices probably rise pretty significantly. But according to the actual BLS data, actual beef prices are up a little over 20%, so barely half. And the reason for that is because they say a certain number of people will say, well, beef's too expensive, so I'm buying chicken. It's called the substitution effect as well. So they'll take that into account as well and say, therefore, inflation is lower. But without just those two different, the hedonic and the substitution, you kind of run into some weird calculations. So I'm going to put you on the spot here a second time, James. I'm sorry about that. But I just like to pick on Australians, I guess, on American stuff. So health insurance, you know, thankfully we get decent health insurance through our employer. But let's say from about September of 2022 to present, how much do you think your health insurance has gone either up or down, your monthly premium?
Since 22, well, substantially, at least a quarter, up 25%.
Yeah, I have four kids. It sure looked like that to me. The actual official numbers are that it's fallen by over a third. So if you think about that, and exactly, how do you explain this? It's the way they look at it is they basically take a look at what the profits are that the actual insurance company gets. If those margins are smaller, therefore your insurance premium is smaller. It's the way they calculate it. So, you know, we have clear problems here because the actual cost of the healthcare itself might be higher. You might be splurging on new offices or a whole lot of other reasons that your actual profits are lower. But as far as, you know, BLS is concerned, that means that that inflation has gone down because of that. So these are all issues though, James, that have been around for a long time, for decades. So, you know, the real question is, have things changed significantly under Trump himself? And we have a couple of little things we can look at, and feel free to stop me if I'm kind of rambling here. For example, there are a couple of different ways that you can calculate the inflation data. ELS employees basically go around to grocery stores. We'll use bread as an example, and they get the price of bread everywhere. They look at it from last month and say, okay, your grocery store in St. Paul, Minnesota, the bread has gone up by 3%. Your grocery store in San Francisco, it's gone up 5%. And then they go ahead and look at all of those and they say, okay, on average, bread prices have gone up X. Something happened since about the time that Trump was inaugurated, and all of a sudden they stopped collecting as much. And kind of the next best way is, I don't have a bread price for San Francisco, so I'll just use the price in St. Paul for everything. And that went from historically, even during the peaks of COVID, less than 20% of those prices were these what are called different cell imputed prices, where I need to get a price from some other region because I don't have it, to nearly 50% now, close to 40%. So what that can do, though, is if you're only collecting prices from areas where prices aren't going up as much, for example, then the overall number may look a little bit lower than it actually is. And so we finish this article, we look at the Bureau of Economic Analysis, who does their own inflation calculation. They like these substitutions a lot more. So James's pizza is too expensive, he's going to eat chicken wings instead. They like to do that a lot more. So their rates, or their inflation rates, tend to be a little bit lower than CPI. And if you look back historically, they have been, but kind of something broke around when the government closed, and now CPI is significantly higher than PCE. So not saying there's a big conspiracy theory here, but some of the data looks a little wonky and weird. And on top of that, there's already all of these different things built in that kind of make inflation lower than it actually is, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and we wonder, just throwing out a possibility, if job cuts during the whole Doge and de-staffing have really made challenges for the no doubt very, very hardworking government employees who are trying to put those stats together. But obviously, I think you've highlighted these. It's useful to kind of get into the weeds, and I think some of these inflation numbers are eye-opening, because I don't think what the average citizen feels, but they're also critical for helping the Fed in terms of driving its rates. Let's move on from inflation and jobs to something very topical, which is Iran. Now, this is a tricky one, right? Because, of course, we have about a week between recording and posting, and that situation feels very fluid, and something could easily have happened by the time we go to air. But listen, I think, Charles, let's have a little chat about what the implications might be for commodities if the US does mount additional strikes in Iran, which seems likely.
Yeah, we've got the largest concentration of military power in the Middle East since 2003. And generally, when somebody puts this all together, they kind of put it together for a reason to use it for something, right? Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, let's just kind of assume that we end up doing some kind of intervention into Iran. We kind of have a couple of different potential scenarios, right? The intel right now says that Trump is looking first at a fairly quick attack to kind of bring Iran to the table and hope they make a deal. And if that doesn't work, then do a longer attack. And so both of those for commodities kind of have different outcomes, right? And within Iran itself, it's a large steel producer. Most of that steel, though, ends up being used domestically, for example, because of all of the tariffs and outright embargoes that have been on Iran for decades now. It's most of Iran's things like that happen internally. Iran's a big exporter, as we know, of oil to China mostly. But the real issue isn't what would happen to those kind of marginal Iran exports. The issue is geography. And so the issue here is the Strait of Hormuz, right? It's a roughly 20 miles at its narrowest, 20 miles of width, roughly a fifth of both LNG and oil flow through there still. And the big question is, can Iran do anything to shut it down? And our feeling is they don't really need to. They just need to make it difficult enough that insurers don't want to insure those vessels anymore. And there's a lot of precedent to this. Most recently, we saw this with the Houthis firing a bunch of missiles against a bunch of different tankers and other ships, to the point where it got frustrating enough that insurance companies stopped covering those ships, and they had to go all the way around the Cape instead of going through the canal. So we could definitely see something fairly similar this time, I think. That's kind of the issue we're looking at here. And I think it's something that's been discounted by the broader markets, and something that people should sit up and pay attention to as this goes forward.
Probably, I think the two-phase thing is interesting. If this is a day or two of strikes, probably it doesn't have a meaningful impact on shipping and so forth. But if this is in any way drawn out, yeah, I think we will definitely see that pushback from insurers. And then at that point, either the commodity prices soar to a level that can accommodate that kind of an insurance cost. You know, makes me think back on when we had a whole lot of piracy off the Horn of Africa. You know, we, first of all, you know, that really wasn't targeting coal or iron ore ships, you know, the commodities we cover. It was targeting mainly oil ships, but it did affect every vessel because insurers refused to go there. So, you know, we certainly have plenty of precedent here. But it also, yeah, either we get prices rising to a point where an insurance cost is covered, or we have to truncate flow to some degree, right? Now, with LNG, it's interesting because we are moving into a significant risk of oversupply. Okay, late last year, we started seeing US exports really stepping up, and this LNG wave that's been talked about for a long time is kind of starting to break. But at the same time, losing a third of the world's LNG or somewhere around that out of the Gulf would be very, very impactful, of course. Be interesting to see. I think there could be steel impacts, but you know, in the long term, if there were regime change in Iran, say, then maybe Iran returns to being a steel exporter more broadly. But that is a topic that would be medium to long term. Nothing in the near term, and honestly, and really not in our base case expectation either.
And I think you kind of hit it pretty well that, you know, the timing of this, Europe is going out of the kind of heating season. So LNG disruption won't be as big of an issue. This is being done after what was being done in Venezuela. Great article, by the way, you wrote on that. Same thing. Venezuelan cargoes are now going to Israel. So that's another source of seaborne oil that you may be able to see. So you can kind of understand the thought process going into this. But again, to your point, it's kind of needs to wrap up fairly quickly, or you could run into some serious longer term issues.
With that, we're going to wrap things up. But before we do, Charles, just curious what you're kind of looking at now and what you might be writing about over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, sure. So those of you who have kind of stuck with us, we've set the table at this point, kind of looking at the big things we focus on and determining where the macroeconomy will go. And let's get into the more interesting things now. We wrote before about gold and how there were attempts to kind of usurp the greenback as the new international currency and the issues behind that. The biggest being there's no portability really with gold, right? And so we're going to look into stable coins and get everyone, you know, a basic primer on crypto and different types of coinage they might use in that and how that could be a threat against the dollar. It's very interesting that Scott Bessent said China is indeed working on some sort of a gold-backed stable coin. He would not deny it. Let's at least put it that way. So it's going to be an interesting area for us to look at. We have geopolitical hotspots everywhere. Continue to look at the Russia situation, and will that end at any point in time? And will that mean that embargoes and tariffs and everything else against Europe, will that go away as well? You know, we look at Europe, the European manufacturing is fascinating because it's been just in a terrible situation for so long. But the last few months, German new orders surged mostly off of defense. Will a defense rearmament kind of bring Europe back to the fore in manufacturing? And then not only that, we need to take another look at South America. We've got the issues that happened in Venezuela. There have been some unkind words around Colombia. We know Brazil is not particularly loved by this administration. And even, you know, seemingly more trivial things like Cuba, when you have Mexico threatening to break embargoes with Cuba and things like that, how is that going to affect the relationship with what is now the U.S.'s largest trading partner, for example? So yeah, James, with the table set, we have a whole heck of a lot we can look at here going forward, and you know, excited about where things are going next.
And I think in the next edition of this podcast, we'll have a bit of a chat about Japan, which has been something, after writing about the US and the global economy, I think Japan is the one you've written about the most. It's obviously a huge steel exporter. It exports ferrous scrap and autos, and also a big importer of thermal coal, met coal, and LNG. So listen, with that, we'll wrap. Thanks everybody for listening. If you are interested in finding out more about Tariff Talk, happy to send you a few samples. Just hit us up. If you're interested in subscribing, we can certainly put you in touch with our account managers too. And if you have any questions you'd like us to discuss on air, do feel free to email those in. With that, let's call it a day. Thank you very much, Charles.
Great. Thanks for the time, James.
Thanks, everybody.
We hope you've enjoyed today's insider conversation on Opus Talks. Join us next time for a deep dive into another industry insider's world. You can find more Opus Talks episodes at opusnet.com/podcasts or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.